Game on, weeknights from 6 on 2FM.
Thanks to the two Johnnies, it's Monday the 3rd of April and this is Game On. Coming up today, with the Leicester and Chelsea jobs vacant, we'll discuss the latest moves in the Premier League managerial merry-go-round with Alan Cawley and Stephen Kelly.
A weekend of mixed results on the rugby front, Shane Byrne gives us his 2 cents.
And with the Allianz Football League done and dusted, Peter Canavan and Neil Ewing wrap up the action.
And if you want to get in touch, please text us on 51552 or tweet at GameOn2FM.
So Marie, it was an entertaining weekend, I suppose, on many, many fronts. Had you a highlight from it all?
There was a lot going on, all right. But for me personally, I was so worried about Katie McCabe last week when she ended up in the boot after her Champions League quarterfinal. But to see her out and about at the weekend, Arsenal played against Manchester City. She started, which was a big surprise because there had been quite a lot of talk about her injury. Now, it did come clear that it wasn't a major injury, but I still didn't expect to see her back playing. But not only was she playing, she scored an absolute cracker for Arsenal to win the game, but she was also, like anyone that knows Katie McCabe, and Alan Cawley's here as well, he might have a view on this, she does seem to get up to a bit off the ball as well. At one stage, the ball went out over the line and she was going to take in a throw, and Chloe Kelly from Man City was kind of going for the ball, and she bopped it off her head and got a yellow card, right? So she went over and hit her head with the ball to say, like, get out of my way, this is my ball. And it was after that then she got the goal. But for a player like her, and Al, you might have an opinion on it, so might you, Ruby, I can imagine if you're a manager, she'd drive you absolutely crackers because she could do absolutely anything. And I remember seeing Vera Powell one day calling her over and like saying, get away from whatever you're about to do there, and you have to have a chat with her. But she's able to stay in the zone. So she can have these outbursts, or she can have these moments of red mist, and she can still go and do something amazing. Like the goal she scored was an absolute cracker from outside the box, like top corner, won the game for her team. But a few minutes earlier, she had like completely lost the head. It's amazing, Al.
Yeah, she's a fantastic player, as we know, and obviously we've watched her closely with the women's team and the progression and the development over the years. But what I love about her is she plays with personality, Marie. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing with her. She has that bit of fire in the belly. She has the bit of development that you need as well at elite level sport. And when she's on the pitch, she's there to win. And I love that about her. Obviously, she has the quality to go with it. But you need those type of players and characters in dressing rooms as well. A dressing room and a team is made up of all sorts of different personalities, and she certainly brings that. And I'm sure the manager loves her for that.
Ruby?
So Marie, you there with your UEFA badges now and whatever level you're on now, how would you deal with her?
I'd find it really difficult because you don't want to knock that edge out of her, because it does give her an extra percent, I think, because she goes like 100% all of the time.
I'm so glad you answered with that line, first of all, because I would have failed you on your B license straight away. You can't take that out of her.
Yeah, you can't. Yeah, and I wouldn't want to. But at the same time, like, I can understand going in for a tough tackle, but the getting involved with referees and maybe getting involved in things like that, she didn't need to go and hit her on the head with the ball. Like, she could have maybe... I don't know what she could have done. She could have told her to go away, but she did go that little bit too far. It would be very difficult, but I think you'd probably have to try and get a little bit of balance that she does keep the edge but doesn't cross the line too often if possible.
So, but Alan, as an ex-footballer, like, do you have to exert some bit of authority over the opposition at times too?
Yeah, and that's what I love about her, because obviously passions are running high, Ruby. As you know, they're playing against one of their rivals, Chloe Kelly, England international as well, and she wants to assert her dominance on her opponent. So I have no problem with that. Obviously, you can't cross the line, and as you say, Marie, there in explaining that, you don't want it, but maybe a temper it a little bit. Mm-hmm. But I think as she grows and matures as well, that'll probably kind of eke out of her as much in terms of the red mist stuff, and she'll be able to control it a bit better. But I love that about her. That's the passion, because the one thing we applauded her throughout the campaign as well was when games were in the melting pot and you're looking for someone to stand up, and you often hear the phrase in football when you're watching matches, who's going to grab this game by the scruff of the neck. She is that. She's that person that does that, and I love her for that. So, as I say, I think the manager and I think her teammates will love her for that as well. You need a bit of devilment.
I think she gets a lot of yellow cards, but then seems to be able to get a handle on what she's doing after that. So she doesn't get as many red cards as you'd expect, but she does. She gets the yellow and then she kind of calms down a little bit. So it's a bit of a skill.
Needs a wrap on the knuckles, make herself behave.
Big time. What about you, Ruby? Any sporting highlights?
Don't know about a highlight, but I actually felt sorry for Montpellier. The Champions Cup, played Exeter, 33 points each after extra time. And Exeter win on a try countback, 5-4. So Exeter progressed to the quarterfinal. I thought, what a miserable way to lose a game. I mean, you score the same amount of points as the opposition, you're as entitled to go through as they are. I think that's a miserable way to lose a game.
Yeah, I remember, Ruby, during the pandemic when the only sport that we had access to was the was in Australia and the rugby league, and they did the, it was like a sudden death overtime system. They called it the golden point, and it was brilliant. It felt like there was one nearly every weekend, but they would just keep playing until they got a winner.
Exactly. Be it a drop goal, be it someone give away a penalty, or a team scores a try, whatever it is, but let there be a winner. I think a try countback, that has to be the worst one I ever heard of.
It's a funny game, that rugby, isn't it?
Well, since we're on it, been a funny game. Al, I'll get your sporting highlight in a little bit, because Shane Byrne happens to be on the line. Shane Byrne, is it a funny old game?
Yes, it is. You guys are dead right.
It is a miserable way, though, to bow out of a competition, dire. Isn't it?
Absolutely dire. Listen, the way the structure of the Champions Cup this year, it's a bit all over the place. It's not normal at all. And yeah, for to go out of the competition like that was you know, cruel. Really was.
So just on the Champions Cup, it kind of crept up on us. I kind of felt out of nowhere. And then all of a sudden, you're turning on the telly on Saturday and Munster in action in South Africa, and I did get actually distracted by the, I don't know, did you see the kids zone? They had the swimming pool at the end of the pitch with two slides down into it. They had an Astro and a load of bouncy castles, and all I thought was, I really need to get to Durban to watch the match. But very quickly the gloss went off it, and you could see the Sharks were really dominating.
Yeah, the highlight was the kids zone.
It
fairly
really
sharpish.
Yeah.
No, but it really was in truth, and Munster scored a couple of tries towards the end of the game, which almost put a different colour on it. It was a fully loaded Shark side and a very, very dangerous team going forward in this competition, because unfortunately Munster just couldn't get a handle on the game at all.
They were okay at the half time, Shane, 17-14, but then 26 yes. points in 17 minutes at the start of the second half. It looked like men paying boys.
Yeah, in the third quarter, I don't know what happened with Munster at half time when they came back out. There were issues starting to show in the first half, and you know, Sharks' execution wasn't exactly where they would have wanted it to be. But just in the third quarter, I don't know whether it was Sharks stepped it up or Munster just switched off, but my God, their execution was superb. But the defence, Munster with it, and then Graham Rowntree has been talking about it, like, it's just, they seem to just turn off for that quarter of the game, and it was an absolute killer. Really was an absolute killer.
Just looking at the bigger picture here, and as we often go there, you could see it was very evident that there was a power deficit between the two sides. Is that a worry looking to the summer, or guess maybe we need to factor in where Leinster are before we think where Ireland are?
Yeah, well, look, the South Africans pride themselves on the power game, and playing against South Africa was always my favourite international team playing against, because if their plan A, which is obviously go at you physically, doesn't work, they'll do plan A harder. And that's the way they play rugby. They just absolutely want to take you on physically. So to meet these guys, these guys are in all competitions that we're in now at the moment, so we really do have to step up and be able to take this punishment. And look, I don't think from an international point of view that we, you know, I think we're not the most physical, but we're physical enough to be able to weather a storm against these guys. And the provincial sides are just going to have to learn to do the same thing, or else you will find these South African sides, because they do a lot that they play without a lot of their internationals for a lot of the teams, or a lot of the games, like we do in ours and as well. But when they do fully load a team, they're a formidable outfit.
They most certainly are. Their pace and execution was something to watch. But that was Saturday early afternoon.
Yeah, sort early afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
very
so
early.
Just fairly afternoon. But Saturday evening, Shane, was definitely the highlight, I suppose. Leinster Ulster 30-15 was the end result, and it never looked in doubt. Difficult conditions, but it was an entertaining game.
It was, actually. The two sides really did give it a go, considering the conditions. It was dire now. I was at the game, and, you know, the rain just, it only just got heavier. You know, it never stopped throughout the whole game until actually the final whistle, and then it dried up completely, which is totally ironic. But the two sides really did have a go at it. Like you say, Leinster never looked like that the game was slipping away, but there was a point that like Leinster didn't settle. So Ulster did have the opportunity. There were a couple of times when I thought, a little more slickness from them, a little more direct play might have served them well, because Leinster were dropping balls, the passes weren't going to hand. And ironically, the turning point to me in the whole game was Gibson Park's try, which was actually from a spilt ball. And he slipped out through a tackle, just gathered up the slipped ball, slipped out through the tackle of Stockdale and went underneath the post. And from that point on, you could nearly see the Ulster players' heads dropping. They had created some great rugby, the crossfield kick from Ulster. They had played some great rugby, the superb mauling try going over the line, which Leinster could do nothing about. And they just didn't capitalise on it. And Leinster, once they got the nose in front, they really just strangled the game away from Ulster.
That crossfield kick was from Billy Burns to James Hume, and it was his yellow card. Now, it just happened to be him. It was a result of penalty after penalty.
Multiple,
but that was just Leinster pressure, wasn't it? It was incredible to watch.
It was. And that's what they do. You know, it's not just their attacking style or their defensive aggression. It's the summary, the sum total of the whole game. They really do strangle sides out of the game if they're allowed to get into it. The only way to stop Leinster is to don't let them settle. And that's what I was saying, is that Ulster had their opportunity, because Leinster didn't settle into that game. There was probably a bit of a hangover from the Six Nations, from the lads just getting their heads back in the game again. That would have been the big challenge that Leo Cullen would have had in the week, trying to get them very, very settled into it. And it was a bit worrying for a while, but once they got that bit of breathing space on the scoreline, the game, they just took control of the game and strangled Ulster out of it completely.
So they are going to be playing against the Leicester Tigers on Friday. Actually, that's going to come around really quickly as well. Stuart Lancaster was out facing the media today. He spoke to Michael Corcoran, and he told him about the challenges that his side are now facing, or the Leinster are facing.
Obviously, the English champions coming to Ireland. It was a really tough game last year when we went to Welford Road, and ironically, we've drawn them same stage. This time we're at home, but they're playing well. They've won the last six games on the bounce, and Richard Wigglesworth's done a brilliant job since he's coming in the interim role, really.
They're a club with a really strong pedigree, both domestically in their own league and indeed European.
Yeah. No, they'll pride themselves on their European record. And obviously they're backing that up with, great success in the Premiership last season. As I say, in the last six games, they've been exceptional, really. So, very aware of a lot of their players, myself personally. And obviously haven't played against them last year, whilst there's changes with, Genge going and Ford going, Nadolo. They've replaced them with quality players, and the likes of Pollard, etc. They'll be fired up for sure.
Shane, Gary Ringrose was passed fit ahead of that game. Caelan Doris and Josh Van de Vleer are still going to be assessed during the week. But just in terms of Leinster's ambitions, if they don't win the Champions Cup this year, how much of a letdown will it be for them for their season?
A huge letdown, I would say, because it's, the way it's working out, if they continue winning, there's a huge advantage. They literally have home the whole way through now to the end. If they can continue to win the way the draws are and the seeding is done, that they would be in the Aviva if they choose to be all the way through to the final. So it's there for them. Look, we know that the talent is there. Like, considering what the side did at the weekend, and then they have, potentially Doris getting back in and Ringrose, two of probably the stars of the Six Nations. Doris, to me in particular, was just absolutely outstanding. And the games that they're playing now, it's almost that it's up to them. It's how they decide to deal with the game. Leicester, look, we know they have huge pedigree. They're third, I think, in the Premiership at the moment. They're on a massive win streak in recent times, playing a very, very physical brand of rugby, very, very direct. But I do still think that it's going to be up in the Leicester's hands how they deal with this pressure and how they can inflict their game plan onto Leicester. Because if they play well, I think Leinster just have too much for Leicester the way they are at the moment.
Yeah, you'd have to think so. Let's move on to the Six Nations, Shane. Ireland had a very harsh day out on Saturday against France, losing 53-3. It's actually hard to find anything real positive to say about it, except that you would hope they'd improve for the Italy game. But it was difficult. It was difficult to even watch, I felt, Shane.
Yeah, very much so. And added to that, France were down a player for quite a sizable amount of the game. Look, they're in a different stage of professionalism. There is no doubt about that. We're just dipping our toe into it and perhaps not fully in it yet. France are several years into professionalism already, and the gap is there, unfortunately. It is very, very sizable. It'll take a few seasons for us to catch up. And but look, the passion and everything that the Irish team showed, it was there. They never put their heads down. They were just on the day outclassed. And you know, it's very, very hard, as you say, to pull any positives out of it. The team, I'm sure, will be working very, very hard to improve the things that they didn't get right. But certainly, a hard day out.
That's two hard days out. Obviously, the loss to Wales as well. Mm. What does Greg McWilliams have to do now before the Italy game? How does he try and build some bit of momentum?
Yeah, and the Italian side isn't bad either. Like, the Italian side would be a bit of a challenge as well. And Wales is another professional team as well. You know as well as I do, it's that you've got to keep the head focused on this. You can't let the heads go down, although it's a very, very hard thing to do. He's got to keep the spirit in the camp, and that they can go out and challenge to the best of their abilities. And, you know, there's little things that you can't control sometimes, the fitness levels, the strengths of professional players you might be playing against. But you can, you know, reduce missed tackles, make sure that the physicality that you play is in the game, make sure when you have the ball that you're doing everything that you can do, that the set piece is good. Little things like that he's just going to have to make sure that, you know, when we do have the opportunities, we take them. And that is all about keeping the form in the camp, keeping the spirits high, so that when they do go out against the Italians, they take all their opportunities and get that win.
Yeah, it's not done for them yet, that's for sure. Shane Byrne, thank you so much for joining us. We'll be talking to you again soon, no doubt. We're going to take a very quick break, but do stay with us because we'll be reflecting on the Allianz Football Leagues very, very shortly. QFM. Yeah, welcome back. It is time to turn our attention to Gaelic football. I'm delighted to say that Peter Canavan is with us, and also Neil Ewing is along as well. Peter, the leagues are over and the championship's starting in just a week's time. It's actually hard to believe.
Yeah, and isn't that great, Marie?
I wouldn't mind just one week, maybe. I mean, I'm not playing or anything, but you know, just one week to recover from the leagues for me would be grand.
Yeah. Look, the league was a very intensive programme for all the teams, because all the divisions were very competitive and there was a lot at stake, no matter, especially with the round robin coming up and different permutations that's going to bring with it. So, it was very intense, and you do feel, especially for the like of Mayo, because their reward for winning a national title is that they don't get to celebrate it, that they have to focus very quickly on what's going to be a massive game against Roscommon, and certainly they'll not be taking them for granted next weekend. So, yeah, definitely the likes of Mayo could have done with another few days, there's no doubt about that.
It's not much of a reward for winning, Peter, but when you looked at Kevin McStay in Croke Park yesterday, he looks a man that's pretty content, pretty happy, and celebrating didn't really seem to bother him.
No, and isn't he dead right? To finish top of Division 1 after the seven games in itself, and I don't think anybody can dispute the way that Mayo have played since Kevin has come into this job. They have played very much on the front foot. They have went after every team that they played against. He's mixed up his style of football with, you know, Aidan O'Shea playing at the edge of the square. They're trying to use him more. It's proven to be very effective for them. So, and despite the fact that they've lost a few key players at the start of the year, they've lost a few players from injury, you only have to look at their bench. Ruby, yesterday, for the quality of players, Owen McLaughlin, Kevin McLaughlin, Tommy Conroy, Killian O'Connor, and the Hessian, who has been one of their best players this year. So things are certainly looking up, and Kevin has every right to be happy.
Neil, is it fair to say that he's rebuilt that Mayo team now and that he's in a situation where he has competition for places as well, and he's got a lot of confident players now and the momentum behind him?
Yeah, he certainly has.
Definitely.
Yeah, sorry. Go on ahead, Ruben.
Go on, Neil.
No, I was just going to say, yeah, I think he definitely has rebuilt that team, Marie, but with a lot of help from James Horan as well. You know, I think James Horan had probably planted the seeds for the rebuild of a new team in the last year or two of his reign. But Kevin McStay has definitely taken that and ran with it. And I think it also speaks to Mayo as a football county. You know, the club football scene in Mayo would be very, very strong. There'd be a lot of serious effort going in at senior and even intermediate level. You know, so the raw material is probably war there, but the way this league has panned out for Kevin McStay has been pretty close to ideal. You know, to, as Peter says, top the league itself after seven games, and then you know, to go on to Croke Park and win a national title in Croke Park while getting those new faces in. I think, you know, Peter mentioned the bench as well, but you have to look at the likes of Enda Hessian and Killian O'Connor, who didn't even tog out yesterday. You know, they're two guys who will be hugely influential. You know, Enda Hessian probably their go-to man in the full back line, and it's going to be very interesting to see, you know, with that added depth, how he uses the likes of a Killian O'Connor there. Obviously Killian is a great score getter, but you know, we've seen Tommy Conroy come on yesterday and he was, I think, you know, electric is the only word you could use to describe him. So he's going to be gunning for a place in the first 15 now that he has a bit of game time behind him after the injury. And you have Aidan O'Shea and Ryan O'Donoghue in that full forward line. So does Killian O'Connor possibly become a very, very impactful substitute for Mayo as the championship pans out?
That's Mayo. Kevin McStay looked happy, so you expect Pádraig Joyce maybe to look disappointed. But Peter, he didn't. He almost looked content. Has he reason to be?
Well, maybe he feels it'll be easier to get his men fired up, because there's no doubt about it, they're going to meet Mayo later on. There's every possibility that they'll meet them in the Connacht semi-final, and that'll be for the third time this year. None of them has got knockout consequences, because there's every possibility that they're going to meet later on in the round robin or quarter final or a semi-final. So I think Pádraig's looking at the bigger picture. What he's also looking at from yesterday's game, they didn't play for the first 10 or 15 minutes. I was led to believe they're actually heading away for a few days abroad on a training weekend, and I heard the flights were that they were actually leaving last night. So looking at the first 10 minutes of the game, I actually wrote it down, half the team was thinking of the flight rather than thinking of these Mayo boys, because they simply didn't, you know, they didn't turn up, they weren't up for the fight, and Mayo ran away. You know, they were 6-1 up after 10 or 15 minutes. So from that point of view, Galway did recover. I'd say he had a few words with them maybe at half time, and they did come back out. They created goal chances. They were very wasteful, which is not like Galway. And they lost Johnny Heaney. So despite the fact that a poor start, not playing great football, minus a few key players, you know, they still had opportunities, you know, to get back into the game. So I have no doubt that Pádraig would be thinking of the bigger picture, and he would see that there's much more in this Galway team.
Yeah, by all accounts, they're heading to Portugal for a break, which would be pretty nice, and the absolute opposite to what Mayo were heading into. But Neil, just from Pádraig Joyce, and as Ruby said there, like, he didn't look too deflated or anything. You could tell from him that he's probably learned a lot from that encounter and is going to be storing it for when they next meet again. But do you think that he's kind of figured out maybe a way to play against Mayo? Because for a lot of it, they were able for them.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, I think a lot of the time, obviously it's the most important metric, but, you know, we get very distracted by the scoreline. You know, I think Pádraig Joyce has a lot to be happy about yesterday. You know, you look at Mayo's goalkeeper got man of the match, you know, three or four brilliant interventions to stop Galway goals or Galway goal chances. Shane Walsh had probably an off day on place balls. So, you know, there's quite a few scores that maybe, even if Galway get 50% of them on another day, you know, they're going away as winners. And, you know, I think the big thing for Galway is a lot of their bigger, or not bigger players, but more important players, Shane Walsh, Damien Comer, Rob Finnerty, probably haven't had the game time during the league that they would ideally have liked to. So the 3 week break that Galway have now to the championship is absolutely ideal for the likes of them. You know, you got more game time into them yesterday. Killian McDade is likely to come back. You know, obviously he'll hope that Johnny Heaney's injury isn't too serious. But yeah, I think that display yesterday and added to getting away on the training camp this week and then another 2 weeks when they come back to get ready for either Mayo or Roscommon is leaving pretty Portraitz Joyce in a pretty happy or content place this morning, if not happy to lose the game.
Peter, do you think Desi Farrell had a similar conversation then in the changing room as Portraitz Joyce had? Because Dublin seemed to come out in the second half and just almost turn a switch. They were a different side.
There were a different side. A couple of things. Just back, Ruby, to all the points that Neil made, I totally agree with. The other aspect about the Galway performance was, did they show their true hand? When it comes to attacking opposition kickouts, Galway's one of the best teams in the country at it. They've got a line of big men across the middle, Conroy, Tierney, Daly, Maher, Cook, yet they didn't push up hardly on any kickouts. They allowed Mayo to win the ball from their full back line. So come the big day, whenever it's knockout, you can be rest assured that Galway's going to be more aggressive. So I don't think that they really revealed their true hand. Regarding Dublin, Derry, the Derry goalkeeper and Derry were very aggressive on Dublin's kickouts. At times Oran Lynch was actually in the Dublin half. He was that far advanced. So they really did put the squeeze. But Dublin's performance in the second half, or the fact they ran away with so easily, I think you can say yes, they upped the ante somewhat. But Derry lost Conor Glass, and the way Conor Glass plays for Derry, he plays virtually like a second centre half back. He provides brilliant cover. He's one of the best tacklers in the game, and cutting out teams coming forward. So him going off left Derry very vulnerable at the back. They were already without Chrissy McCaig, and one of the best man markers in the country. So without those two players, I think Dublin really went to town. You can question, you know, some of the goals that they got. The first one was a square ball. The last one, definitely, Lorcan O'Dell was going for a point, finished in the top corner. But there's two or three other chances. I think I counted eight, and they had eight goal chances over the course of the game. So from a Dublin point of view, that's impressive, the way that they can break down a defence that, you know, so focused on so many bodies back there.
Absolutely. And we did hear Rory Gallagher as well talk about the lack of depth that they have. They're such a small squad. So when they lose two players, as you said, like McCaig and Glass, then things are always going to be tricky for them. But from a Dublin point of view, Neil, okay, they scored four. They probably could have had eight goals, but they only scored 6 points and hit 11 wides. Just from a Dublin point of view, it's quite a low return.
Yeah, definitely, Murray. I think, you know, yesterday was very reflective even of Dublin's league campaign. You know, probably a certain amount of teams in Division 2 that they just had a big quality gap on, they were able to beat at their ease. But, you know, when they were tested, none of those tests did they come through, you know, with flying colours or unblemished. And yesterday there was lots of mixed stuff as well. You know, very exciting to see Conor Callan kind of back to his explosive best. Didn't get any scores, but he just looked like such a handful, so powerful, so hard to handle. You know, that was a definite positive for them. Brian Fenton, James McCarthy in the middle of the field just, you know, showed their quality. You know, even McCarthy, he's the first person I've seen Brendan Rodgers struggle to deal with. But I think a big thing that the two guys for Dublin did show was just the defiance, which is definitely going to be important when they're tested come All-Ireland semi-final stage, if it progresses to that. But then, you know, similarly in attack, and, you know, maybe it ties into what you mentioned on their low point scoring tally, is just a few basic skillers that you would have never associated with Dublin when they were at their best. Over the last decade or so, just trying passes that maybe weren't on, or, you know, just a pass, just half a metre behind somebody, too far in front of somebody. decision making more so than poor skills, and they just looked like a team that were maybe forcing it. Now you probably do have to give Derry a bit of credit for that, in terms of how they set up and how good they are defensively and even getting contact on. And you know, it becomes a lot harder to make those good decisions when you're playing against a team that's getting hands on and clouding that decision making process.
Peter, under Desi Farrell, do you see a clear identity that his Dublin team play with? I know he's been so disrupted with COVID during his reign, but like, can we recognise this Dublin team as Desi Farrell's, or is it a case of, with so many players now returning to the fold, is it maybe a little bit of evolution but not so much a revolution?
Yeah, I think that's fair enough, because they still have so many of their key players from a previous era, you'd have to say that. But you know, has he brought in his own younger players into it? You'd have to say he's tried to do that. David O'Hanlon in goals, and I know all the talk has been about Stephen Cluxton, but O'Hanlon has been superb, and I know Derry put serious pressure on his kickouts, but he figured a way around that, and in the second half I thought his kickouts was excellent. And he made another very important save in the course of the game. Lee Gannon is a player that at the start of the year you wouldn't have been naming him as going to be one, you know, in the top two or three Dublin players. He has been really consistent, bombing forward, getting scores, setting up scores, but also defending really well as well. So, yeah, there is. Desi has put his own stamp on it, but, you know, I said it last night, they are capable of winning an All-Ireland. There's no doubt about that. There's scope for improvement, and I think they're timing their run much better. They don't need to be flying at this time of the year. They don't need to be flying for the Leinster Championship. They have three or four games in the round robin and then quarter-finals. So when you take the fact that they can get sharper, they can bring on Jack McCaffrey, Brian Howard's going to be involved, Merchant, Paul Mannion. I think come, you know, another 7-8 weeks down the line, this Dublin team can be and will be a real force to be reckoned with.
There's obviously two more finals in Division 3 and Division 4. I think, Neil, we will leave Sligo to you in 1 minute. So first, Peter, Cavan obviously got the better of Fermanagh, and from 4 up the 3, now heading to 2, they've rounded the season out perfectly, haven't they? In the league season.
Yeah, they are. Yeah, they would have been the team that you would have been picking out. Not many would have expected Fermanagh to get promoted, but we witnessed in the first half, you know, their style of play, they were very hard to break down. And, you know, big Darren McGurn, his finish, one of the highlights of the weekend for such a big man, the way he put it away. But Calvin, again, Mickey Graham, very astute manager. There's nobody better at setting a team up for the opposition that they're playing. He made a few tweaks. I think, again, he asked more from his players in terms of aggression. Their turnover count in the second half was exceptional. And they have proven, I suppose, why they're not. They shouldn't really be in Division 3. They won Ulster a couple of years ago. They still have quality players. And they're in the sight of the draw. They avoid Throne, Derry, and Monaghan and Ulster, so I've no doubt that Mickey Graham would have his sights firmly set on reaching an Ulster final.
What about Sligo then, Neil? They beat Wicklow 2-10 to 14 points, but if we were just to look ahead for Alan Colley's fist pumping here, by the way, big GAA fan here in the studio.
If you're ask him where Markovic Park is.
Neil, no. Directions. Don't you start, Neil. I certainly time as a young GAA player in Sligo Town as well.
I'll have to see photographic evidence of that.
Just given how competitive Connacht is, though, what's the aim for Sligo this year?
The aim for Sligo this year, I suppose one of the big aims has been achieved, to get promoted back to Division 3. To win the silver at the weekend was a bonus on top of that. But, you know, if I was a player in that Sligo squad, you know, leaving Croke Park Saturday evening, there would have been a little bit of fear in my mind, because they have a trip coming up this weekend that I don't think anybody in Connacht football wants to take, and that's to head over to Ruislip. Similarly, Leitrim are heading off to New York, but they really are, they're no-win trips. But the aim for Sligo has to be to get into a Connacht final, and with that, there's the carrot of been involved in the Sam Maguire round robin series. So you know they're probably going to end up in a group with the Munster winners or runners up, and obviously you know two teams that are qualified through their league status then as well. So you know that's going to be brilliant for Sligo if they could achieve it. It'd mean a big home game during the summer. You know, great opportunity for those Sligo footballers to showcase what they're all about at home in Markovitch Park in a big summer game. And you know, even in terms of inspiring the next generation, winning that silverware at the weekend was important there, but you know that game during the summer will be huge as well. That's definitely going to be the target. I'm sure Tony McEntee and his management team will play that down, but it has to be the target. But the same way that is the target for Leitrim as well, Andy Moran, he'll have his charges itching to put things right if they get another go at Sligo after Sligo beating them in the winner takes all league game. And then on the flip side of all that, there's no point saying otherwise. Any year that London or New York have Sligo or Leitrim travelling to meet them in a championship, they view that as a serious opportunity to take a scalp. We've seen in 2013 where London beat Sligo and then beat London in a Connacht semi-final, ended up in a Connacht final and played a qualifier against Cavan and Croke Park. So, you know, both the managing teams in England and in the US will have their players set up for an ambush on the two guys going to meet them this year. In terms of Saturday's game for Sligo, it was, you know, a strange performance. And I think, to be fair to all four teams that played on Saturday night, the conditions were woeful. And, you know, the rain just never stopped during that Division 4 final. For Wicklow, I think Kevin Quinn was very, very impressive. Dara Fitzgerald, you know, started the game flying. You know, you could really see he had something about him, had a bit of pace. Unfortunate, picked up a knock, you know, maybe halfway through the first half, and he struggled for the rest of the game after that, or until he was withdrawn maybe about 10 minutes to go. But Sligo were well on the back foot until Sligo themselves got a black card, went down to 14 men. But the game changed, I felt. A turnover that Sligo had got. Sean Carabine, you know, he's a fabulous footballer. I think a lot of people enjoy watching him play this summer. But he I suppose, showed the other side of his game outside of his attacking abilities when he turned over a Wicklow man coming out with possession under the Cusack stand. Sligo got a point from that and kind of they went on, got the goal before the halftime whistle, and from there they never really looked back. You know, moved into the second half and they were a lot less tentative, got a lot more runners ahead of the ball and showed some of that potential, I suppose, that's mm-hmm. seen them go the last six games in the league unbeaten. So, you know, encouraging to finish like that, but definitely I think the bus pulling out of Croke Park, you know, Mayo have got a lot of sympathy today for not being able to celebrate their victory. But, you know, they just have to go into Castlebar for a game next Sunday. The Sligo lads are on a flight to London Friday morning mm-hmm. to play next Saturday evening.
A good place to watch a match over there anyway, Roy Slip, so they might be able to celebrate a bit there.
To Neil watch, Peter, not to play.
Thank you so much for joining us. Championship this weekend, as I said at the start, I can't believe it. Straight into it, and we will be talking to you again next week, no doubt. Thanks so much for joining us. We're going to turn our attention to swimming now. The Irish Open Championships have been ongoing over the weekend. John Kenny joins us now. John.
Yeah, Mona McSherry, she's the woman of the moment. The Olympic finalist from Tokyo set another Irish record in the final of the women's 50 metres breaststroke here at the NAC, having already won her favourite 100 breaststroke, also in record time over the weekend. The Tennessee-based swimmer cracked in a time of 30.29 seconds for the one-length final, cutting 0.27 of a second off her own personal best and her second breaststroke title of the week, along with the record. And this was the reaction of McSherry after today's final.
Coming right off of short course season and then being able to just come here and compete like that is just awesome, and I'm just trying to get a feel for long course again, and it's going well.
It's gone well, especially in the 100. You're near that 105 magic mark now as well. It's probably a time that you need to kind of consistently need to pop in now between now and the Olympic Games.
Yeah, definitely, you know, keep building on that, and being able to throw down two really good 106s is exciting, and still feel like I have room to improve and things to work on, so that's awesome.
And the 50 obviously is a bonus, I suppose, breaking the Irish record again.
Yeah, no, definitely. The 50 is a fun event. I think it just helps me feel connected to my stroke at higher tempos, and that's always a good thing. So,
How's things in Tennessee for you?
Great, I'm really enjoying it. You know, it's intense, but I like life like that. Keep me busy.
It's a different kind of race schedule there, isn't it? And it's obviously something that suits you. It's been proven in the water.
Yeah, you know, it's very competitive. It's all about racing, and that's something I thrive on. And I think being able to practice those high-intensity meets more often is really going to benefit me in the long run.
Japan's on your mind now as well for the World Championships, a chance to make the consideration times for the Olympic Games.
Yeah, that's definitely my plan, you know, get it over and done with and then have a really good year of hard work before the Olympics.
That's Monica McSherry there. The closest final of the day, the women's blue ribboned, the 100 metres freestyle. Victoria Catterson just got up to beat the Olympian Danielle Hill by 1/100th of a second in a dramatic finale to a fantastic race. And Max McCusker for the men won his third gold medal of the meet of the week, winning the 100 butterfly, denying the Olympian Shane Ryan in a bit of a surprise, denying him the gold medal. McCusker winning gold number 3. That's it from day 3 of this open meet.
Thanks so much, John. We will check in with you again tomorrow. We're going to take a quick break now, though.
Game on 2FM.
Well, welcome back to Game On. So it's the managerial merry-go-round that I suppose we're going to have to jump into. And where do we start, Alan? Graham Potter or Brendan Rodgers?
Who do we have the most sympathy for, if any?
Graham Potter.
Why would you not have sympathy for either? Oh, are you that hard and horrible?
Well, it's a ruthless...
They both just got sacked. Like.
It's a ruthless industry, Ruby. I'm just asking the question. Do you have any sympathy for
him? Well, he gets sacked from the under-8s now.
Well, depending on how the tournament goes tomorrow, he'll be getting the chop tomorrow evening. But the I would have massive sympathy for Potter. As you know, I'm a fan. I've defended him all through. And it's a tough one to take for him, obviously. But just, I suppose, when you look at results, it looked like he was swimming against the tide for the last kind of 4 or 5 weeks. It looked like he might have turned around following the Champions League win. And there was a couple of league wins as well in that kind of 2 or 3 week period. But the draw last week against Everton, late goal as well against them when you think they should be hanging on. And then I watched them Saturday evening against Aston Villa. Now, Aston Villa have improved under Unai Emery, but you'd still expect Chelsea with the players that they have, with the squad, resources, all that kind of stuff, you would expect them to be beating Aston Villa at home. And I just felt as soon as that result went against them, unfortunately for him, his time was up. But you'd wonder and you'd question about the management of the club, Ruby, because when you think, it just goes to show you the money that's been spent on this club by Todd Bowley, and they literally treat them like play toys. And when you think of all the money that they've spent in terms of players as well, getting behind Potter initially, giving him a bumper contract over 5-6 years, saying we're building for the future, bringing in a lot of, signing a lot of younger players for the future, and you go and sack the plan and tear it up after 7 months, it's bizarre, really.
But Stephen, when you look at the stats from Saturday's game, Aston Villa 2, Chelsea 0 is the only one that matters. But 27 shots to Chelsea, 5 for Aston Villa, 8 on target for Chelsea, only 2 on target for Aston Villa, the 2 they scored with, 69% possession, 600 passes, 90% pass accuracy. I mean, what does Graham Potter have to do if his players can't put the ball in it?
Yeah, you look at those stats, and I think it's for Chelsea, some of the times that's been the case. They've been dominant to some extent in games, and Mudrick had so many chances, and you kind of thinking that's a player they've just spent almost 100 million on, and if they can't put the ball in the back of the net from that close range and that with those chances, you feel like, you know, what can he really do? But it's, I suppose, it's about an atmosphere that's been created, and Chelsea as a football club, where they see themselves, they do not see themselves as a team that plays outside the Champions League, and that's it, isn't it? They can't see, for the money they've invested in the manager himself and then in the squad, that there are teams that should be languishing in the position they're in of 11th. You know, I just don't think that's good enough for Chelsea. And as much as I'd love to see Potter get on and do well, but I just think that this is Chelsea. And to be honest, I don't think his reputation will be that tarnished from it. I think he's gone in, it's a difficult situation. The club has changed ownerships, they've brought in loads of new players, new faces. But I still think someone like a Brighton or around that level would take a punt on Potter, because they feel he's a manager that's capable of getting, you know, improving players and bringing them on. It's just Chelsea's just not worked out.
But Al, I don't think, just given everything that's happened over the last while, that he'll get a shot at a big club again, because there was the narrative coming out of Chelsea was that some of the players had to Google who he was, you know, that they didn't have that respect for him because he didn't have the big name like Mourinho or Zidane, whoever. So while he might go back down the table, that was his shot, really.
Yeah, and that's sad, Marie, for me, because if players are doing that, it just goes to show the power of the player nowadays as well, and a lack of respect in terms of managers that are out there, just because you don't have an elite name and somebody comes in with the stature of Graham Potter and they're disrespecting him from day one.
You could see some of the body language.
Yeah,
though, from
it
the
was
big
often,
players,
it really
yeah.
was. And I'd love if you were to sit down with Potter. I know, like, obviously the way it's panned out in hindsight is easy, but you'd love to just question, was it the right move for him at the time? His stock was so high at Brighton. You're going into such chaos at Chelsea as well, and we all know that from over the years. Maybe he got kind of assured from the new owner, and the fact that he backed him and he took him at his word, that maybe that's why he jumped and he felt, this is my chance, as you say, to manage an elite club. But it's just been an absolute disaster for him, and I'm sure a lot of the players that were signing, we were making jokes about it around January. There was fellas walking in the door left, right and centre, and probably half of them he didn't even want, and then all of a sudden it's like a kid in a sweet shop. There's so much to choose from and you don't know which one to go for. So it's just been a disaster for him. I hope, as Stephen said, that it doesn't kind of tarnish his reputation going forward, but I agree with you totally, Marie, in the sense that his chance at an elite job, it's gone.
Stephen, those rumours can't be true. There can't be a player in the Premier League who doesn't know who the other 19 managers in that division are, or can there be?
See, some of them came from outside.
You'd be surprised, Ruby. You'd be surprised.
Yeah. What does that tell you about the mentality of the people playing the game?
Yeah.
They can't use washing machines, Ruby, for God's sake.
Mind the washing machine. You don't know the opposition are. I mean, I find that just mind-boggling.
You've clearly
it's
never
a blinkered mentality.
Player.
Yeah, it really is. A lot of lads just are so self-focused that everything else aside them is white noise. They just don't pay attention to it. They're only focused on their own individual ability and their own what they're doing on the pitch. And I know that sounds extremely selfish, and it is, and self-centred, but a lot of players are like that. The thing is with Potter, though, you feel like if the players are not knowing who he is, as soon as you come on the training pitch, if he puts on a decent session, you respect them. So as much as I say, yeah, fair enough, they don't know who he is, but like Mourinho had to earn his name in football. All these managers start somewhere, and you respect them based on what they're doing in training and what you feel, the information you're getting, you're going onto the pitch. Like when Stephen Kenny took over Ireland, he wasn't an elite manager. He wasn't an international manager. He earned a reputation in the League of Ireland, but he on an international stage, that's a massive development. But those players play for him now to a high level, players that played in the Premier League. So it depends on what you're doing and the information you're getting across. And if there's a disparity between that, what Potter's given and what the players are expecting, then that's maybe where it came in. When it comes to not knowing who he is, I take that with a pinch of salt, though.
I played with one of the most high-profile centre-forwards who got capped for Ireland in the League of Ireland. No interest in football. I used to come in the next morning, we'd be training, and say, did you watch the match last night? No, I'd be all enthusiastic about it and couldn't wait to chat about it, and he'd be looking at me as if I had three heads.
Yeah, and look, I'm with you, Al. Like, there's so many people I've interviewed over the years that do not have any interest in sport beyond, they just see it as their job, and that's what they do, and they go and do it, and they come away, and It's more commonplace than you actually think, that they just don't follow sport the way, like, we work in sport, we love it, we watch it, we're entertained by it. There's plenty of people that
I don't mind people in one sport not knowing what's going on in another sport, but working in one sport and not knowing what's going on in your sport is a completely different thing. That's arrogance. That's beyond arrogance now.
Well, often people who are paid millions of
and that's the problem as well,
Euros or pounds to kick a ball around a pitch.
That's the problem.
Don't see beyond that ball, and simple as that. Mm.
And that's where, again, I go back to the mismanagement with Chelsea. You have an owner there now who it's a toy, and he'll do whatever it takes in terms of throwing as much money as it takes to get them to where he wants to be, and it's his toy.
Ruby, the one that springs to mind for me is Balotelli. So remember when Balotelli was here and the amount of clips that went viral where he was abandoning his car, he couldn't put the bib on, he was just like, it's crazy some of the stuff that goes on.
I can't believe it. What about Brendan Rodgers then? Where's he going? But Graham Potter not get the Leicester job, no?
Go on, Stephen.
Yeah, see that, this is the thing, you're saying, would he get the Leicester job? And you think, well, potentially, but then is he what Leicester need? Like, Leicester sacked Rodgers because they don't want a progressive manager that can get them out of the league from the championship. They don't want a manager that's going to improve all the players. They want a manager that's going to have an impact straight away. And is Graham Potter a manager that's going to change the way Leicester are playing, or change their turn them into a team that's actually competitive and make them hard to beat? I don't know. I actually don't know whether that's what he'll do. Will he coach them? Will he make them better players? Will the players respect him? Probably, because he's got a decent reputation winning in the English game, but to some extent, I just don't know whether he's the right option.
Yeah, and they're in dire straits at the moment, Leicester, financially as well. So on and off the pitch, it's a disaster. And it's just basically, Rodgers a very good coach. Things have gone a bit sour. Obviously, he's done a brilliant job over the 4 years, but things have gone sour in the sense that they just can't suffer the fate of relegation because of the money and the financial problems that they have. That's why they spent no money on the summer when Rodgers was calling out for, obviously, the squad to be strengthened. They sold Fofana for, was it 80, 90 million to Chelsea, and they only bought the lad Fies for 17 million. They didn't have any money to spend because they don't have it. So whoever goes in there, it's basically just a salvage job to try and get them to the end of the season to just stay up. That's, they just can't suffer the fate. For Rodgers himself, I think Spurs might be a good fit for Rodgers. I still think Rodgers' credit is quite high, despite the fact that he's had a disaster this season with Leicester, but I still think he's a very good coach.
It was interesting, Stephen, just listening to Jurgen Klopp today. He was obviously asked about all the sackings that were going on around him, and he's a lot of realism, to be fair to him. He said if it wasn't for
honesty,
his past,
I'd call that Marie.
Yeah, it wasn't for his past achievements, he could probably be next. There is pressure starting to pile on him.
Oh, absolutely. Like Liverpool to be languishing in eighth and performing the way they have performed this season, it's not good enough, but it's not good enough based on what they've done, and they've done what they've done because of him. So that's the difference, isn't it? Like I know Brendan Rodgers had a bit of stuff in the bank because of the FA Cup, but I think what Brendan Rodgers had faltered on, they were in fourth on two occasions and they faltered. They literally just blew it for two seasons in a row, being in Champions League position, yet they went on to win the FA Cup, which they hold in high esteem. It's an amazing achievement for a club like Leicester. Liverpool's different. Klopp has got Liverpool back to winning the Premier League, to winning the Champions League, to a team coming close or pushing probably arguably the best team ever to play in the Premier League, and City and the way they play and how relentless they are. So for him to be able to do that, it's just they're faltering now, and I think a lot for Klopp is going to be based on recruitment. They haven't recruited, players are getting older, there's a lot more going on in the background there than just Klopp's performance himself. And I think as much as there's pressure and the fans are getting disgruntled because of what he's achieved with them, I still think he's got a lot in the tank to be able to, you know, rebuild and go again.
Alan, what about Erik ten Hag? He's got a bit of work to do with United. They didn't look great against Newcastle yesterday.
Oh, they were an absolute shambles, Marie. It was so bad. Such a dreadful performance. Newcastle were great, by the way. Played really well. Eddie Howe obviously doing a very good job. But United were absolutely dreadful. And there's a major problem. Like, he's getting a lot of plaudits, ten Hag, and he has done a good job, and we've praised him for that. But you look at their record away from home against teams in the top nine, it's absolutely dreadful. And a few hammerings in that as well, Marie. And it just goes to show, I think, the deficiency still in the squad. He still has a major rebuilding job on his hands there. You look at Veghorst up front, and I know he was never a long term plan anyway, he was only brought in, but he's nowhere near the level. Dalot, you look at midfield, I know Sabitzer was short term as well, but there's players there still that are nowhere near the level of a Man United or a top elite club, so he still has a major job on his hands.
He most certainly does. And gents, we haven't got any time to get any further. Arsenal are still top, in case anyone didn't notice that at the weekend after beating Leeds 4-1. But that's all we have time for. Stephen Kelly and Alan Cawley, thanks a million for taking our call. O'Connor produced, Marie Crow was in charge. Benedict De Silva's up next. RTE 2FM.